Construction attorney Tanya Johansson is here to break down the industry on the Pressure Tested podcast. We'll be tackling the labor shortage, those tricky retainage clauses, and how she balanced motherhood with her legal career. Tanya, thank you so much for joining the Pressure Tested podcast. We're so excited to have you here. I can't wait to hear the story about why you decided to become a lawyer.
Oh, my goodness. Well, first of all, as a young child, I was always very goal-driven. My dad was a teacher, and I remember being 4 years old, and I went with him to a graduation. And there were two people on the stage. And I said, why do those two people get to be on the stage and everyone else doesn't? My dad said, well, because they made the highest grades. And I said, oh, so they're the smartest. He said, no, but not necessarily the smartest. He said, they just have the best habits and they work hard. And I said, okay, well, then I'm going to be that person when I grow up. And my dad said, okay. And I was. And so I decided at that time I was either going to be the president of the United States, a ballerina, or a lawyer. But somewhere along the line, actually, it was when I met my husband, and he said, we can't get married until you get out of college. So immediately I sat down, I was 19, and created the shortest path I could find to get married. And that was being a teacher. And he was also a teacher and a coach. So that put it together. And so I did that for 4 years, absolutely loved it, but was coming home from a basketball game that I had been watching my cousin play. And I'd been catching up with friends from college. You know how you do. Well, who's doing this and who's doing that? And I talked to a friend who had a brother who was my age. And I said, well, what's he up to? And he said, well, he's in his second year of law school. And this light went on in my brain. And I was like, oh, my gosh. I'm like one way smarter than he is. So if he can do law school, there's no doubt that I can do law school. So we got in our little Volkswagen Beetle and we're driving home. And I said, Greg, guess what? And he said, what? And I said, I decided to be a lawyer. And he said, yeah, right. I said, I'm not joking. I mean, I'm just telling you in case you want to move to the same place where I'm going to school.
Oh, my God.
I said, I don't know which one is going to be yet, but I'm going to do this. And so I did. I filled out all the papers. This was in December. There was only one more time you could take the LSAT test, which is in February. I took it with about 102 fever and still got into five law
school. Oh, there you go.
Put all the little pieces of paper down on the table and said, okay, where do you want to live?
And you guys chose Lubbock.
We chose Lubbock for a couple of reasons. First of all, I'm sort of from that area, so I have a lot of family that's there. My husband grew up in Iowa, so he was indifferent to that, although he's close to my family. But also, for a very specific reason, I had figured out that I could take the 4 years of teacher retirement that I had, and I can pay for my entire law school college or endeavor and come out debt-free. And so I was like, rather than go to SMU or Baylor, you know, or someplace like that where I did get in, but I thought, I don't want to have all those thousands of dollars worth of debt. I just want to start out, you know, without debt. So that's why I went there. And it turned out to be a great decision. Tech was a great law school. It was, you know, pretty nuts and bolts, which actually was really good in getting ready to prepare for the bar exam.
Okay.
Because I'd had, like, at SMU and other schools, you're not required to take some of these classes. You weren't required to take tax. We were. Weren't required to take oil and gas. We were. So when you got ready to study for the bar, you'd had all those fundamentals, and that made it great.
Yeah, that's really good. So you graduated from college, and you have done just a lot of different roles as a lawyer. So kind of take me down the path of what all have you done in your career?
Oh, my goodness. I started out as a trial lawyer. I was the first and only woman for a time being at Winstead when I started way back when in 1983. So it was me and 67 men. And, you know, I never really paid much attention to that. I didn't actually notice it until we had a firm meeting. I mean, I looked around the room and I was the only woman in the room and I thought, well, it's a little different. So I was an associate there for about 7 years. And while I was going through my associate phase, I got pregnant with my first daughter. And I really didn't know how that was going to go because the fact that they hadn't had very many women by the time I got pregnant. I still think we only had about 6 females. So by the time I got pregnant, I was like, you know, I don't know how this is going to be, if it's going to be difficult, if it's going to be, you know, how am I going to be perceived, all these other things. So I did get a lot of questions about, well, are you going to come back to work after you have the baby? And I was like, that's so insulting.
I think you're sick. People still get asked that, and I know.
I know. And I was like, yes, I am. And they're like, okay, great. We really want you to come back. And then the other question was, well, do you still think you're going to work as hard as you did before?
Oh.
And I was like, yeah, I think I'm going to be working harder because now, instead of just being alive and just being a kick-ass trailer, now I'm going to be a mom. So, yeah, I think I'm going to work harder.
Wow.
I don't know. And then I became a shareholder. And I was there 16 years in total.
Okay.
And I loved it. That is an absolutely great firm. Absolutely. But I left because I got this great opportunity with Akin Gump. And it was a bizarre situation. I had handled like 2 very small patent infringement cases, which there were not a lot of trial lawyers who had done that. So I get a call from Akin Gump and they said, well, we had this giant patent case that we would like for you to come in and work on it. And I said, well, full disclosure here, in all transparency, I am not a patent lawyer. I don't know zippity-doo-dah about a lot of it. So if you're thinking I'm going to come in and like be this great savior, that's not what's going to happen. They said, no, the reason we want you is because you are a great storyteller. I said, how do you figure? And they said, well, because we've seen you before in trial and we've heard you making arguments and stuff. And he said, what you're really, really good at is you're able to take difficult concepts, make them simple, and make them interesting. And that's a success. That's how you be a successful trial lawyer. And so what we need you to do is be able to come in, translate this very complicated cell phone technology into layman's terms and make it interesting. And I said, okay, I want a lot of money.
A lot of money.
That's what's expecting me to do, because that is a pretty tall order.
Yeah.
But it was also interesting. It was a way for me to really expand my horizons and do something that I'd never done before. So there were 3 partners on that case, me, another woman, and another guy, and we all had very different skills.
Okay.
And because I came from a firm at Winstead where I was allowed to do a lot of hands-on, you know, a lot of trying cases and a lot of doing depositions and all that sort of thing, I actually had that kind of experience where at a firm like Akin, it is so big, it was over 1,100 lawyers, that sometimes there were lawyers that were 8-, 9-, and 10-year lawyers who had never taken a deposition. So I was kind of like, they were kind of like very esoteric, the other two. And I was like the one that was like, okay, well, that's all fine. But we need to do this, this, and this. We got to get the ball across the goal line. And these are the things we have to do. So I was kind of like the practical person who had done it and knew what needed to be done. I had a blast. It was fun. That case lasted, I think, 4 years.
So that's all you work on the whole 4 years?
That's all I worked on the whole 4 years. It was all consuming. I think we had something like probably 20 lawyers and 35 paralegals working on it at the same time, because it was huge. It was 9 patents that Ericsson and Qualcomm were arguing about. Qualcomm was my client, or our client. And whoever won that case was going to put the other one out of business.
2-1.
Well, neither. They finally did what we told them to do at the very beginning, which was to cross-license the technology. So that they could each use the other's technology and then come up with a business plan. But sometimes, and this is an interesting concept I've learned, sometimes companies, because companies are made out of people, right? Companies have to endure a certain amount of pain before they're ready to sit down and be businessmen. And is
that true?
This was exactly what this was about. The CEO of Qualcomm and the CEO of Ericsson were so angry about the whole thing that every time they would meet to try to resolve something, it would just end up in a yelling match. So we're like, okay, fine. Pay us
$1 million.
if that's your choice, I'm going to take it. That's fine. So, but ultimately, they both won because they both got what they needed to do. Let's continue doing business, which is the ultimate outcome that you all want. But getting there was really fun. And then after that, I handled a big case for Mary Kay Cosmetics, and it was an employment case. It also very contentious, very good lawyers on both sides, and just sort of beating each other up until finally on the eve of trial, it settled.
Oh, wow.
So that happens a lot with big cases because, you know, if you've ever been on a jury panel or walked in and, you know, actually, from a lawyer's perspective, looked at who your jurors might be. Sometimes you don't feel really comfortable when your first juror has like orange hair. You know, it's like she's the lead waitress at
dinner. Right. Yeah, you don't really want to entrust her with the outcome.
Right. Which is not to say that she may not be the most intelligent human in the world. She may very well be. But, you know, it's hard to entrust business cases to people who don't want to be there.
Yeah,
don't know the technology, don't know the business. You know, we're in the construction world, right? So they don't know anything about construction except that when somebody built their house, they screwed it up. You know, that's all they know.
That's exactly right.
And especially on commercial cases, they don't know any of that stuff.
Yeah.
So you really, taking a case to trial is really a risk. But you have to be prepared to do that if that's what your client wants you to do.
But then they get there and they realize that that's not where they're
right. Right. Sometimes they're like, I don't know. No, I really want to do this. So maybe we need to sit down and settle. So that's how that happens. Then I left after 10 years at Aiken. I left and was very fortunate to be the general counsel at HCBEC. And that was a great experience for me. It really gave me a different perspective on business and construction. You know, I knew construction from the legal standpoint, but learning it from the business standpoint and from what, you know, sitting in meetings with the C-suite people and with the, you know, the guys who were running the projects, project superintendents, with all those people up and down the chain of command and listening to what really concerned them, it really gave me a different perspective on how to solve problems and what really matters to the people in the field and to the people in the C-suite. And it's not always the same thing that lawyers think it is.
Oh, I'm sure it's not.
It's not at all. And so we're worried about, oh, does the phrase actually sound right? They don't care.
They don't even know what that phrase is.
No. They just want to be sure that you evaluate and explain to them what their options are and then explain to the level of risk that they may encounter depending on which option they decide to pursue. And yeah, it's all about, to me, it was all about proactively managing risk. So I can let you take the riskiest position you want as long as you're doing it with your eyes wide open.
Yeah.
That's my job.
Yeah, I think that's the, you know, as a subcontractor, and I remember the first time that I was a project manager and Garrett set a contract down in front of me, and I was like, I mean, I'll read this, but I have no idea what any of it means.
Right.
And I think that's what almost all subcontractors or, you know, even general contractor space. We're not lawyers and we really have no idea what any of that stuff means.
Right. Well, and one of the things I did to ameliorate that problem was I created a training program at BEC. So for every big project that we had, my team created like sort of a training manual on the contract itself. Like,
wow,
here are the hot points. Here are all the notice provisions. Here are the templates for how you send out the notice letters and when they have to go, because that's always a thing.
Yeah.
They don't want to send the letters because they're like, well, this may make, if you're a sub, this may make the GC angry. Or if you're a GC, this may make the owner angry. No. The other ones that put it in the contract, and if you don't do this, then you're going to be in problems because they're going to turn around and say, well, you didn't give me notice. Yeah, that's a problem. So you have to sort of go have a gentle but firm way of explaining this is important. You know, these are the things. I'm going to make it easy for you. Here are the templates that you use. All you got to do is fill in these blanks. And if you have a question, call me and I'll help you. And so I would go out to the job trailers and sit with the main people, say, I'm going to take 2 hours of your time. You're going to be bored out of your mind, but you really need to listen to me and we need to go through this. And they thought it was weird, but shortly they really liked it. They were really appreciative because they said, "You have made it so much easier for us to understand exactly what we need to do and why we need to do it."
We need to do that same class here, because I think everyone from the estimator, the project manager, to Garrett, myself, CFOs, anybody, everyone could benefit.
Robots. Happy to come and give you that class.
What else? I mean, I've been through one of those, let me say this. But, I mean, I went through the class. I felt like the person that was telling me the information was talking in circles.
Yep.
Didn't understand any of it. I mean, I understood enough of it right by, but I didn't feel any more confident when I sat down the next time to read. And I do think that you're absolutely right about that. You have a very approachable way of dealing with things that are complicated. And that's a really skill set.
Yeah,
absolutely.
You know, it was a gift when I taught ninth graders who were studying English. You know, if they don't like English, and being in ninth grade, their hormones are like all over the planet. So you don't know who's going to come into your class on any given day, right?
Sure, that's true.
And so that was sort of my skill, is like taking something that they didn't want to know about, and that was complicated. For studying Edgar Allan Poe, they don't care about all that. So I have to find a way to make it interesting. And it related same way with being a general counsel, being a lawyer in a consultant role, being a lawyer in the courtroom. It's like, how can I explain this in a way that makes sense? Here's a good example of one of my points in the program. I would always say to the superintendents, "You don't realize this, but you are probably the most important record keeper on the job." And he'd go, "I am?" I'd say, "Yes." "Do you do a daily log?" They would go, "Well, yeah." I knew what they looked like because I'd seen them,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And I said, "Well, would it help you to understand why it's important if I give you the following facts? First of all, if this company ever gets sued on this job, there are surveys that prove that the person that the jury most respects and most believes is the superintendent who is on site." Because he is, you know, his main goal is to just get this built. He's not in the upper echelon of all the stuff that swirls around. His job is to get this built. So, and if he's doing a daily log, he's taking notes contemporaneously with what happens. So he has no ability and no reason to go back and change anything. It's a contemporaneous diary of what's gone on that day. So it's important to tell me how many workers were on the site. Tell me what subcontractors were there. Tell me if there were any problems. You know, tell me.
Yeah.
In this document, so that when I have to put you on the stand 3 years later, you're not going to remember this, but I can introduce this piece of this diary to you and say, "Was this your log from this and such day? Do you recall this?" "Yes, I do." "You kept it in the ordinary course of business?" "Yes, I did." "Okay, let's talk about what this says." And the jury always believes them.
Why?
Because they have no reason to have lied on the day that they made, you know, that they made that document. So they were all like, really, "Oh, well, so, okay, I better do a better job."
Yeah.
And then you have to do the whole training of, okay, when you're doing that better job, don't say things in there like, "Yep, this was our fault." Don't do that.
Well, that's funny that needs to get said, but it does. I know that it does. Yeah. And I'm just, I think that there's so much power in just explaining a why to somebody. I think when you just say, "Fill out this daily log," and that's all that they hear, they think, okay, I'm being told to do this, but I don't know why I'm being told to do this, so I'm not going to put a lot of stock in this. But then if you suddenly explain to them why, it just changes everything.
Oh, sure. And they realize how important it is. And some, just by the nature, by their own personal nature, are very detailed. But most of them are like, "It's the end of the day. I've worked 10 hours.
Yep.
I'm exhausted. I'm just going to scratch out a few things and I'm going home."
Yep.
But it got much better in general after we had these training sessions. And then Beck was a little unique, I think, for a general contractor. They had what was called Beck University.
Okay.
And so these were in-house training programs, and each employee was required to participate in 30 hours a year of training. So it could be, you know, on technical type things, or it could be on legal things or whatever. But each of us had responsibilities to prepare these kinds of programs. And the employees had responsibilities to track their hours and actually be at the programs. And so therefore, it made for a more cohesive workplace, a more well-educated workplace, and just, you know, sort of a wanting to grow together atmosphere.
That's amazing. That really leads me to a question that we have previously discussed. You've been in the construction, in and around the construction industry for a long time, especially in this particular region. What, when you look out at the next 10 years, what are your major concerns?
Well, I tell you, my major concerns are that the artisans and the subcontractors and the superintendents and the people who have been hands-on for all these many years, there's not a good way yet for them to transfer the knowledge that they have to younger people who are coming up. You know, we get a lot of people who are coming in with a construction law, or not a law, but a construction management degree.
Yep.
And, you know, so they know all these things, mm-hmm. but what they don't know the nuts and bolts of how it works
right
underneath them. And so there's not been a good way to transfer knowledge. You know, in the old days, we had the apprenticeship program.
Yep.
Where the more experienced people would take a young guy on and they would, you know, mentor him through learning all these processes, and then he would graduate up, and then he would mentor the next one coming up in an apprentice fashion. We don't have that now. So it's concerning to me that a lot of the quality that we currently see is going to be lost over the next 10 years because these people who really know this are all starting to retire and move on to other things. So do we want to go back to, like, you know, starting at the beginning, try relearning this? This doesn't seem wise to me.
But how do you, Melanie Rainey was on the podcast, and we talked a lot about this, but how do you incentivize this group of craftsmen that are retirement age? How do you incentivize them to encourage other people to get into the trades, first off, and how do you get them to pass that knowledge on to them? How do you make this gap happen?
Yeah. I think from my conversations with a lot of the gentlemen and women who have, you know, these years and years of experience, they are very willing to take the time to pass their knowledge on. But it's that the younger folks coming up don't necessarily think it's very valuable. They don't understand the value that they're, the opportunity that they're being given. So there's a gap between how do we encourage these younger folks to realize that there's a wealth of knowledge out there that you need to tap into. So that's one thing. I think that's a challenge for all companies to start considering. How can we best do that? Do we have a Beck University type mm-hmm. situation
yep.
where we require, you know, this type of training? Do we have, you know, monetary incentives to encourage that transfer of knowledge? I'm not really sure what the answer to that is, but I know if we all put our heads together, we could come up with one. The second thing I think is critical is that we as a nation and as the construction industry, we need to realize that not everybody should go to college.
Ah.
Not everybody should be a lawyer. Like, I would not be a good woodworker. I would probably cut both of my fingers off in 5 seconds. You know, I wouldn't be good at that because
yep.
I'm just not.
Yep, same.
But there are people who are masterful at that. So we need to, A, establish programs, which I think we're starting to do here in South Texas. There's, I think it's Collin County College has now got several programs for teaching the construction trades, not the management side, but the trades. How do you do these things?
Yep.
So then we need to get people to go into middle schools and high schools and say to people, you don't need to go to college if that is not what you want to do. You can become a tradesman, be well respected, make a good living, and hold your head up with pride because this is what the nation needs. This is what the construction industry needs. And I don't know that we're putting enough emphasis on that.
Absolutely not. I still think that because there were so many generations of plumbers and so many generations of people that, you know, dug ditches, and they consistently went home and they said to their son and daughter, you'll go to college, you won't do what I did.
Right.
And it's a full culture shift mm-hmm. to go back and try to reestablish. I mean, because even today, like, I mean, my daughter's 8 years old, and I actually just found out she has dyslexia. But I have this, like, idea that Emily's not going to do anything but go to college. She's going to go to TCU, mm-hmm. you know? And it's like, I would never even consider her getting into a trade.
Right.
But it's like, why would I have such, as somebody who runs a company that requires tradespeople, I'm still too close-minded to it. So it's so deeply embedded in who we are that we have this idea that the only way to get better and get further down the line is to go to college. And it's such a, it's really not true. Yeah,
it's really a fallacy. And it's interesting. My husband's sort of a combination of both. He's also in the construction industry, okay. although he builds like very high-end multi-million dollar homes. Like, I really just wanted to live in one of their pool houses and just, you know, they're magnificent, like 50,000 square foot homes.
Wow.
The company he works for built all of T. Boone Pickens's residences. It's that.
Is it Sebastian?
Though it's a smaller company called Tommy Ford Construction. And they're magnificent. I mean, they are. They're just the quality that they do, and they're, you know, high integrity and all those things. So my husband's father was in construction, and my husband is the oldest of three brothers. Mm-hmm. So Greg was always like, I am not going to go into construction. I'm going to go to college. I'm going to get my master's degree. I'm going to coach. I'm going to teach. I'm going to do this. I'm going into business, whatever. So he did that for 8 years. Mm-hmm. But when he was young growing up, he always went to the job site with his father, and his father taught him. I don't think Greg even realized how much his father taught him. He taught him all the basics and all sort of the perfect ways to do things and the high quality way to do things. So when he decided that he no longer wanted to be in teaching and coaching, the first thing he did was open a construction company. And he had a construction company with his younger brother, Terry, who's also married to my sister, who is a lawyer.
Oh my gosh, what?
Yeah. That's a little weird. Yeah. They met at
Okay, that was until yeah. That's so funny.
Yeah,
okay.
They met at our wedding. She's my
Really?
Maid of,
yeah, oh my gosh.
My maid of honor. That's... And Terry was Greg's best man.
No way.
And they met and they kind of hit it off. He was in Iowa, she was in New Mexico, so it was a whole long distance romance thing that went on for about 3 years, and then they got married. They've been married like 45 years.
Oh, my goodness.
And so, you know, it's a good thing we all get along. My sister is an in-house attorney at Goldman Sachs.
Okay,
so
great.
She's very smart. She's very, like, different than I am in the sense that she had the accounting degree, and things kind of fit into boxes for her sometimes, and nothing fits into a box for me ever. I'm like, oh, but what about this? Like, she's like,
I love that.
You drive me insane. Anyway, but, you know, so we had the common mother-in-law, right?
Right. Oh, my gosh.
And our kids.
That's so funny.
I have two daughters. She has two sons. They are double first cousins.
Yep. I grew up with a family just like this. Yep.
They are double first cousins. They look alike.
Yeah.
They act alike. When they were growing up, you know, it was like they say it takes a village to raise a child.
Yeah.
Well, we had our own little village. And they didn't even call us by our names. They would just say, where are the moms?
That's so. And so they live in Dallas.
Oh, yeah. We live about 5 minutes apart.
Really? That's so cool. I love that.
And so
awesome.
It's still fun.
And
it was great. It really was. And we, you know, we all helped each other.
Yeah. That's so great. You had an extra set of parents to help out.
Yeah,
that's awesome.
It was awesome. And my sister always accused me because she's like one of these people who's like, ultra, ultra, ultra conservative, and she reads all these things, and I'm like, it was just not good when the internet came, because my sister gets on there, and she researches all these things, and I'm like, you know what, Shauna, that is really stupid. And she was like, I don't think Garrett can stay at your house because you haven't adequately child-proofed it.
I'm like,
get over yourself.
Yeah.
He's 2 months old. He's like, whoa, he can't even move. What are you talking about?
I will say that it's a little crazy how different two people who are raised by the same people can end up. It just completely different. My sister works for me in heating and cooling, and we cannot be more different. I mean, people don't even realize that we're related. Yeah. They're like, how, you know, we are just opposites.
Yeah.
Okay, so they had a construction company. Mm-hmm. So what happened from there?
They had a construction company for about 15 or 16 years doing home remodeling and new home construction. And then, you know, because they were so small, they loved the building part of it, but the whole bookkeeping and all that stuff, they just got tired of doing it. So they dissolved their company and they both went to work for different builders here in Dallas.
Okay.
And so they've been with different builders here in Dallas, but same industry.
And I bet they consistently see that the just level of craftsmen that's needed. So heating and cooling does new construction, and we do high-end new construction, residential HVAC. Mm-hmm. That's our bread and butter. But it is so difficult to find people that understand. So my husband is the guy that grew up in the trades. He understands. My husband works for the business. He understands the level of quality that's needed. And we just, there's no one getting into the field to pass that on to. It's crazy.
Right.
I mean, it really makes you wonder, what is it going to look like in 15 years for those particular types of groups? You know, plumbers, electricians, HVAC guys. It's just...
Well, I think we have to change the paradigm of what we're telling our kids and what we're promoting. Because as said, certainly I needed to be the one that went to college and became a lawyer. I would have been terrible at anything else. Like, I can't even do arts and crafts. They come out looking bizarre. My daughters are like, really, Mom? Yeah, please, don't help us.
Yeah, that's me.
But Dad, when they want to build like the gingerbread house, he's like Mr. Architect person who measures it all out and it stands up and it's beautiful. And I'm like, thank you, God, because he can do this and I can't.
That's my exact household.
Yeah. But we have to have a different emphasis starting in the middle school, like 6th, 7th, 8th, 9th grade. We can't always be tracking kids and pushing them to college. We need to have dual tracks where kids can say, and be proud of this.
Yes.
Be proud of
That's the important part.
Is saying, I want to be in HVAC. I want to be, you know, in woodworking. I want to be whatever. And they have to, we have to imbue in them a sense of, that is great. That is fabulous. The world needs that. You are a success. Because what we've done is we've made them feel that they're not successful if they don't go to college. And that is absolutely not true. So it's really on us and on the school system to make that change.
Yeah, I think the school system definitely needs to play a part in that, for sure.
One thing that we can do to help as business people in the construction industry is we need to get out to the counselors and the whoever the right person to go to is and say, we would like to come in on career day or some other day, and we would like to give a presentation about HVAC and what it takes and why it's important and why it's such a lofty craft and how much money you can make and where can you get this training and what kind of life can you have? Because they have the impression that it's not a successful thing. I have a niece who is a teacher here in Texas, and what her class trains kids who are not going to go to college to become chefs.
Okay.
And that's what she does.
That's cool.
Yeah. And she really imbues in them a sense of pride. Like, you don't need to be a doctor or accountant or any of these things. You be a chef.
Yep.
And you be the best chef you can be. And I've watched it, and I've watched these kids change from being very downtrodden and feeling like they weren't going to be a success to being very proud of who they are.
How do we, man, you're right. We have to do this.
We do. And it's up to us to get out there and stir the pot, because it's not going to get stirred.
That's the part about being the parent that does it too, you know, because you kind of say, oh, you know, I think that, you know, even in my own brain, and this is what's wrong with, this is what's wrong with America. But even in my own brain, as we're having this conversation, I'm like, yeah, other kids need to hear that. I'm like, well, What about my own daughter? Does my own daughter need to hear this? Because I think it's great for all these other kids, but I'm still thinking, you know, Emily's going to TCU.
Yeah.
It's like you almost have to start with, like, you know, making yourself believe it and then pushing it out.
And I really think you have to talk to your kids and expose them. Here's the thing. Kids are not exposed to what is done in the world. Like when I was a kid, if you would ask me what a banker did,
yeah,
I didn't know, really. I mean, they were at the bank and they did something with money, but I didn't know what it was.
Yep.
You know, so we need to expose them to more career paths and opportunities and really explain to them, okay, this is what you do. You know, this is why this is important. And this is how it fits into the big jigsaw puzzle of the economy. And there is a way to do this, but we just have to not be lazy about it. Mm-hmm. And like my brother is exactly 1 year and 3 days younger than I am. He majored in fraternity for about 5 years in college.
Garrett also majored in that.
Yeah. But my brother Randy never finished. But you know what Randy could do is amazing. Like he could look at a car motor and he could take it apart in his brain and put it back together like more perfectly than anyone I've ever seen. So he went to trade school and he advanced up through that profession and became very, very successful. If you gave me a motor to look at, I have no idea. And I used to ask him, how can you see this?
Yeah.
He's like, well, how can you read all those dumb point things that you read? You know, it's just the difference in people's brains.
It is. Yeah, it's definitely not a one-size-fits-all for sure. Okay, I want to talk about this because I think it's so near and dear to my heart. I just have this perception that, and you know, Garrett's a lot better at this than I am, and God bless him, he's great at this. But, you know, we land a project, okay? And it's a big project. It's, you know, and we work so hard to get it. And then we get a contract in front of us. And, you know, you're so tempted to just say, yes, Mr. GC, let me sign this document and hand it right back to you. You do whatever it is that you want to do to us. We are just happy for the work. And, you know, and Garrett's always kind of said to me, no, you know, we're going to redline this. We're gonna look at that. What advice do you give to subcontractors when, you know, they sit down with that contract? Like, how much should they be working to negotiate those contracts?
They should negotiate it. They should negotiate the contract because if you've already, you know, mostly a company, a GC, they're going to look at your bid.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Then they're going to say, okay, this was the bid. We accept this bid. And then here's the subcontract. You should negotiate it. You should, and I don't know if you only work in Texas or if you're planning to spread out and work in other regions.
We only work in Texas right now.
Yeah. But we expected subcontractors to come in with a red line.
Okay.
Now, I wouldn't accept all of them because some of them were goofy, you know, but things that made sense, and I would sit down with them and we would discuss it. And I'd say, well, why is this important to you? Tell me what this means for your business and why this matters. An example, retainage.
Retainage.
We had a lot. So you're on the front end because you're like HVAC.
Yes. Yeah.
And let's say the project is like a 3-year project.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So you're out here, you're doing your work, everything's fine, it's been accepted, you've been paid everything but your 10%. But that 10% can be
entire profit.
Yeah, it can be your profit. And so your cash flow is not as you would like it to be.
Right.
So what can your general contractor do to alleviate that situation? Well, as a general contractor, we were also aware that this was a problem for the subs.
Mm-hmm.
So depending on what flexibility we could get from the owner, and sometimes we couldn't get any, but we also don't want the owner withholding the whole 10% from us either.
Right.
And we don't want them charging retainage on our profit, on a lot of different things. We have kind of like a laundry list of things that we would negotiate with them about. But one of the things that we always tried to do is that when a subcontractor was 50% complete, that if we were withholding 10% retainage, we would get to reduce it to 5% and pay them the other 5%, which helped them.
Absolutely.
Ultimately.
Yes.
And then we would try to get a concession from the owner, because it always has to come from the owner.
It does.
Ultimately.
Yep.
That would say, if they're front end and everything is fine and the architect has accepted the work. We as the GC are happy with it. You as the owner, you're happy with it. There's really no reason to keep that retainage any longer. We should go ahead and pay out that retainage to them and let them move on. Now, we were not always successful in getting that, but it was worth a try.
Absolutely.
So as a subcontractor, it's worth a try. The worst that someone can say is no, right? And then you're just in the same position you were. So why not try?
Why not try? No, I completely agree. And we struggled.
And don't be afraid to negotiate. You know, I could tell you the points that you're never going to win on, but that's not one of them.
Well, that's good to hear.
You know,
because that's the one that I think, especially for a new subcontractor who's just getting going, that's I truly believe that retainage is the number one thing that takes you out, especially, you know, in those first few years where you're trying to figure out how to make profit. Mm-hmm. And if you're not a very niche subcontractor doing very specific work, there's not a lot of margin in it anyway.
Oh, I know.
And I mean, I sat in this, you know, not in this building, but I sat in this company while we struggled with cash flow because of retainage. And, you know, a lot of people will say, like, why do we need retainage at all? What are your thoughts on that? Do you think Texas will ever be a state that gets rid of retainage?
Well, Texas has a statute right now that many owners rely on. And I haven't seen any movement in the legislature or the lobbying or anything that would indicate to me that we're going to get rid of retainage. Mm-hmm. But I will say that there are some states who manage just fine who don't have retainage.
Right.
New Mexico is one.
Really?
Yeah, New Mexico has no retainage. You can't withhold retainage in New Mexico. It's against the law.
Hmm.
So, you know, in fact, I had a project in New Mexico and my guy called and said, we're going to withhold 10% retainage. I said, no, you're not. Because you can't. You would like to, and it's not possible. Here's the statute.
Oh, my gosh.
Which is the benefit of having a good, knowledgeable lawyer,
yes.
You know, and have them up front and have a rapport with them and know that they know your business so that they can help you. Because really, some people view lawyers as like, oh, they're just the naysayers. They're just the people who come in and tell us everything that we can't do, which is really not what lawyers want to do.
Yeah.
We really want to help you get to your business goal in the most efficient and effective way we can while still, you know, keeping you within the confines of the things that we can't negotiate. But we're really your business partner, but a lot of people don't see it that way.
How important do you think it is for a subcontractor just getting started? You know, we went through this. We didn't really know if we should send every contract over for our attorney to review. And I'm sure we signed a lot of contracts we had no business signing. Do you think a subcontractor just starting out should have a lawyer reviewing all of their contracts?
Absolutely. Because you may think that the subcontracts are all the same, but they're not.
Mm.
There are nuances in them, and the nuances are connected to the nuances that you were going to find in, even if you're using AIA documents,
mm-hmm.
if you see my AIA documents, how marked up they get.
Really?
Like whether I'm representing a sub or whether I'm representing a GC, they're going to be marked up because I'm going to look at both of them. Okay, here's an example. In a subcontract, mm-hmm. you will always see a phrase that says, you as a subcontractor are entitled to see the GC's contract. Most subcontractors, they don't take advantage of that. You should, because the next sentence says, you are bound to all the same responsibilities, duties, penalties, obligations that you are bound to the general contractor in the same way that the general contractor is bound to the owner.
Okay.
Well, if you don't know what those are, then how do you know if you want to be bound by these or if you even can be?
Wow. I can't think of a time where I feel like I've seen that. I've seen that
in
a document
before.
It's in every
contract.
And I don't know that we've ever asked for one.
Yeah, in every single contract. I have a big client who's a subcontractor. And I, when I'm reviewing their subcontracts, I review every subcontract over a certain $1 million amount.
Okay.
Like, not if it's $20,000, but if it's over a certain $1 million amount, I review every one of them. I review them nationwide.
Okay.
And I always say, okay, I cannot give you an absolute answer on this until I see the prime.
Ah.
I need to see the prime because there are certain provisions that I know are in there that I have to review and then compare it to what they're asking you to do over here in your subcontract, because you may not be able to do that. It may not be to your benefit financially to do that, but you don't know, right? So my advice is that if it's a subcontract of substance, you should always have a lawyer look at it beforehand. However much that money is, and it shouldn't be like an exorbitant amount. I mean, I know how much I charge. I charge way less than I'm worth. But, you know, I think it's well worth the money because, you know, that saying, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure.
Oh, yeah.
If you've ever been involved in a lawsuit, it's horrible. And you spend so much more money than you would have spent if you'd had the contract reviewed up front.
I've got something for you. And we are deep in the legal construction path, and I'm okay with that because I think, or at least I hope, there are a lot of subcontractors out here that are going to get a lot of good information out of this. What do you see with, you know, I get pushback, and being a CFO of a construction company, I was very quick to say, if I'm not paid on the 15th, the very next day, you are going to get a notice from my lawyer saying that I didn't get payment.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, then we get GCs, oh, we're mad at you for this. Or, you know, oh, you know, we got a notice of retainage. You know, you guys are, yeah, you're substantially complete. But why are you sending this? You're making the owner mad. And I'm like, well, I'm protecting my money. That's what I'm doing. And so what are your thoughts on that?
My thoughts are you send those letters. That's it. Whatever your contract tells you, you have to send, and you should send it in a certain timely manner.
Mm-hmm.
You do it. If you can rely on the Prompt Payment Act, rely on it, because, you know, you have to have some leverage as a subcontractor.
Yes.
To make the general contractor exercise whatever leverage he has against the owner. And all this business about, oh, we're going to get mad at you for sending a letter. Many times I have sat across from another lawyer who said, well, my client doesn't, they don't want to send that letter because it's going to make somebody mad. And I've said, well, I can fix that for you. Here's this little addendum.
Mm-hmm.
And it says subsection A, B, C, D, whatever it is that requires the notice, is no longer applicable. Signed. And then I'll sign. And then I don't have to send you any more letters.
Okay.
But if you're not going to sign, you're going to get letters. Mm-hmm. That's the way it is.
Yep.
Because if you don't, you are really risking your ability later on to recover.
Yep. Okay, well, so, I'm going to keep pushing that narrative. Thank you for backing me up on that. Okay, so tell me what it was like. We've talked about this a little bit, but what was it like raising two girls while you were climbing the corporate ladder?
It was chaotic, but delightful at the same time.
It's good.
You know, I had a lot of people who said, oh, you can't do that, and don't you feel guilty because your daughters are being raised by a nanny? And my answer was, no, I don't, because they're not being raised by a nanny.
That's right.
The only difference between you and I is I'm working, you're playing tennis at the country clubs.
So, yikes.
You know, I'm sorry, but on balance, you might think I win.
I hate that. You know, I have so many stay-at-home mom friends, and God, I think they're great. I think I'll talk about Easter. Easter came around this year. It hit me quick, okay? And, you know, it's Saturday night. It's 10:30. I don't know what I'm doing. I'm sitting at home, and I'm thinking, tomorrow is Sunday, and I think my daughter still believes in the Easter Bunny, and I have absolutely nothing for her. And then I start, you know, I wake up in the morning, and I'm like, you know, maybe this is the year I tell her there's no Easter Bunny. And, you know, I start looking at my feed, and there's all of these moms and just these elaborate Easter baskets. And I'm like, I'm a bad mom. I didn't have time for this year. It's like, I'm not a bad mom.
No, you are not a bad mom.
I'm not a bad mom.
You're not a bad
like,
mom.
I didn't have time this year to build an Easter basket.
No.
But I was running a business, and I was doing the best I could.
Yeah. Well, and I think that's just fine. I was the mom who is in the same position, who was at Walgreens at 11 o'clock at,
me.
You know, with the Easter baskets going, yes. What is anything that's got Easter on? It's
that's
going
exactly
in these baskets.
That's exactly what we did the very next day. We were at Walgreens. Just
you know what? They never knew the difference.
Yep.
They really didn't care. It was all about, you know, it was all about just the fun of doing it and being together and all of that kind of stuff. And they really never felt deprived. I think where children feel deprived when you have a very high powered working mom, mm-hmm. is if you are not present in their lives in the times when you need to be present. For example, I think I told you this story the other day, but like, I'm not a neat freak. I have one sister who is, and she says, how can you sleep with your closets looking like that? And I'm like, it doesn't even
peacefully.
Bother me. Yeah, it doesn't even bother me at all. But she literally will come to my house and try to clean out my closets. And I'm like, Marka, please, you're making me nervous. Yeah. But
that's funny.
There was one Saturday when I wasn't working. My daughter Jordan was probably about 8 years old. And I decided, for some reason, that I was going to clean the hall closet. I'm pulling out all these things that I don't even know what they are or why they're even in there. And Jordan comes running upstairs and she says, Mommy, let's go to the park. And I said, well, Jordan, I'm cleaning out this closet. Mm-hmm. And kids are so wise sometimes, right? She looked me dead in the eyes and she said, Mommy, I will never remember if we had a clean closet, but I will always remember the times that we spent together in the park. Okay, all that stuff went right back in the closet. We went to the park, had a beautiful afternoon, and that reminded me, every time I would like get stressed about I'm a bad mom and all this sort of thing, I would remember, no, I'm not, because I am prioritizing the things that need to be prioritized. When I'm there, I'm really there for them. Like, I don't go home after work and sort of get on my phone and, well, I didn't have phones back then,
yep.
but, you know, do other things. I'm with them, listening to them until they go to bed. Now, I may stay up until 2 o'clock,
yep.
finishing all the other stuff, but I'm there for them. And that's the stuff you cannot contract out. You and I talked about this. Laundry,
yes.
house cleaning, cleaning your car, all those things. I'll pay to have all that done.
Yep.
Because I don't have the extra time to do it. It needs to be done, and I want it to be done, but it's not going to be me doing it. When my husband and I first got married, and I was first a lawyer, he's sort of a neatnik, and he was like, well, why didn't you vacuum this floor? And I was like, well, I'll make you a deal. I said, I'll vacuum the full floor if you pay me my hourly rate as a lawyer. So I will need $400 an hour.
I love that. I love that.
And then he goes, you know, it is so not fair being married to you.
No, I think that's great. And I think that, you know, it's kind of funny, but I mean, I just recently started sending out my laundry. It was the best decision I've ever made in my entire life. And every once in a while, I'll be home on the weekends and I'll say, oh, you know, I mean, maybe I'll just grit it. I'll do this. I'll do my own laundry. You know, I'm going to save the money. And, you know, it's funny, if I ever tell any other moms that I'm sending my laundry out, oh, the grief that I get back for sending my, you know, I've had just a ton of moms that are all they work from home, which is a new dynamic. This is a
that
new
was
dynamic.
Not done
okay.
When I started.
Like, I can't between meetings do my laundry.
No.
And so I'll get grief. You know, they're like, oh, you know, that's just ridiculous. You can do your laundry. You don't. And I'm like, you know what? I'm not going to make you feel bad about anything you do, and don't make me feel bad about anything I do, and I'm just going to do the best I can.
Yeah.
And it's like every year I get a little bit more okay with that.
Yeah.
I'm just doing the best I can.
You have to. You have to surround yourself with people whose dreams are as big as yours. And, you know, your dreams include whatever they include. If they include being the mom who wants to stay home, be hands-on, do the laundry, do all the cooking, all that thing, that is a beautiful dream.
Yep.
It was just not mine.
Agreed.
I mean, I told my husband long ago, before they had all these, you know, like factor meals and all that you could order and cook.
Yeah.
I said,
those are my refrigerator.
Yeah, that's mine too. I said, this would be a great business for someone yep. to do. And I said, you know, we don't actually need a kitchen. We need a coffee pot and we need a microwave. And then we need a drive up window where they could just drive the food up. We could take it in
yep.
and put it in, because we don't use the kitchen very much.
Yep.
So I laugh on all these like home remake shows and everything where they're all about, oh, the kitchen is the center of the home. Not at my house.
No. No, that's so funny. I just, we bought a house, as you know, it was built in 2012, and I love the house, love the neighborhood, don't love the kitchen. And I just had somebody at my house a couple days ago, and they said, oh yeah, well, you do realize that you're going to be without your kitchen for like 2 or 3 months. I was like, we don't use it.
Yeah.
I just want it to look pretty. I was like, it's not going to disrupt our life at all to not have this kitchen. I was like, we eat out. Or we're going to order and we're going to throw it away in the trash can. That's going to be all of it. And they couldn't believe that I said that to them.
I know. Like, I got a lot of grief about, not about the laundry, but about the cooking.
So many
of my friends would ask me, well, how do you get home by 6 to cook for your family? My eyes would just cross and glaze over. And I'm like, seriously? 6 is like midday for me.
Health work. Yeah, I mean, I will say, you know, because I have had a couple of lawyers on the podcast, and, you know, I had a lawyer. It's funny that we were talking earlier, but I did have a lawyer that, you know, she started her own law firm, and they do it all from home because she just didn't, you know, before working as a lawyer, there was an 80-hour commitment.
Oh, yeah.
And she was like, I wanted to practice law, but I didn't want to make that commitment. Mm-hmm. I wanted my life to look different.
Perfectly fine.
And she's super successful. She's done a great job. I mean, I just think that, you know, we just have to break down all these barriers and these preconceived notions of what things look like.
Absolutely. And, you know, also with technology, it's getting more flexible.
Absolutely.
You know, when I started, and this is really going to age me, but that's okay. Lawyers were not even allowed to have computers because we weren't trusted with them, which was probably good at actually.
Wait, what?
No, we were not allowed to have computers on our desk or even really to touch them because they didn't trust us with them because we would probably mess it up. Everything we did, we dictated into a dictaphone. We gave it one of those little tapes.
Yes.
We would hand it to our assistant. She would type it all up, give it back to us. We would manually correct it, give it back to her. She would put the corrections in, send it back to us. We'd read it and make sure it was fine. And that's how it went. And that was how it was probably the first 6 or 7 years I practiced. Then people got desktop computers, but not lawyers.
Not lawyers?
No.
This is so wild.
Only the secretaries got new upgrades.
Oh, okay.
And then laptops came out, and finally we were allowed to use laptops.
Okay.
And take them home. But it was just not a thing.
Interesting.
You know? And cell phones, we didn't have cell phones. I didn't have a cell phone until I did the Qualcomm case.
Really?
And that was one of the little perks they gave us was, here, we're going to give you this phone. and it was about that big, you know. And
oh, yeah, like the big gray one?
Yeah, the big ones, yeah. And but we were all, oh, that's so cool we've got. But, you know, then you didn't have anybody to call because no one else had cell phones. So, I mean, it's really, really changed, like,
that's,
you know,
great.
With cell phones and being able to, everyone's connected and can work from home and all these sort of things. It makes it so much easier and yet so much harder, because it's harder in the sense that clients often expect 24/7 access.
Oh, absolutely.
And, you know, back in the day when I first started, when you went home, you were home because they couldn't find the, you know, there was nothing they could do.
Right.
There was
right.
no way to get a message to you unless they would call you on your hard line phone. And, you know, most of the time they would get your answering machine. So
what a nice little break.
Yeah. Yeah. So
that's nice.
It's really, really evolved in both a good way and a bad way.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I feel like there's always a situation that could happen that needs my attention on my phone. I mean, I could get an email at 9:30 about something. I could get a text message that somebody got hurt. I mean, there's always something that I will say that I think that makes it more difficult with young kids at home.
It does.
Because when you get home, you're never really off. You're always worried about something that's going on because somebody within that business has access to you.
Mm-hmm.
And I, you know, me and my husband talk about this a lot, but like it's a real thing to just say, hey, while it would be fun to sit here and look at my phone or to answer the 1,000 emails I just got, like I'm going to sit it down. I'm going to leave it at the front. When I walk in, I'm going to walk away from it. Because if not, I'll just never... You never walk away from
it. You never disconnect from it. And I found, you know, after I did get cell phones and stuff like that, my girls were a little bit older. They were like in elementary and middle school. But I would just have to put it in a drawer and just not do anything with it until they went to bed. And then I would go look at it or look on my computer and say, okay, I have to do this, and I have to do this before in the morning. And literally, I might be up until 2:00.
Yeah.
And then we had the mom code. This is a funny story. So when I first started practicing, there were no women in executive positions. It was all guys.
Yep.
So when, you know, I'd go into a meeting, I was always the only woman. You know, so there was really, like, no one to network with yet. So when I finally had been practicing maybe about 10 years, women in banks, they started ascending. You know, they started becoming senior vice presidents and stuff like that. A few more women became in-house counsel. So I had this one case in Puerto Rico. It was a construction case. And I was the lead lawyer. The senior vice president was a woman. And the in-house counsel was a woman. And we all had kids that were almost exactly the same age.
Okay.
So we had a code because guys can say, oh, well, we're on the golf course. We'll call you when we get back, and then it's okay.
Yes.
But as a mom, if you said, oh, well, I'm at ballet recital with my daughter, it wasn't as cool.
Oh, yeah.
So
of course.
We just had like this code that we had with our secretaries that if one of the women on this case called and we were somewhere with our kids, our secretaries would just say, who were all also female, would just say, I'm sorry, she's in a lengthy meeting. She will not be finished until 7 o'clock tonight.
I love that. That is so funny.
And so at 7
That's great.
Yeah. So at 7 o'clock at night, and that's what they would tell all the guys who were looking for you.
Great.
I'm sorry, she's in a lengthy meeting. She won't be finished until 7 o'clock tonight. May I take a message? Is this urgent? I will get it to your to her, but you won't hear from her till 7 o'clock tonight. And so we always used to laugh because our conference calls on that case, they would be at 9 o'clock at night.
Oh,
after we got our kids to sleep.
Oh.
And we'd been through with soccer and whatever else we were doing.
Wow.
So, I mean, you know, there's always ways to make it work. You just, it's like a recipe. You know, it's like the really great chefs, they take a basic recipe and then they experiment and innovate and put all their different ingredients into it and it becomes a masterpiece. That's kind of how your life is. When you're a woman, and well, even when you're a guy, you know, there is no recipe. You got to make your own.
Yeah, I love that. I think that's fantastic. Tanya, thank you so much for joining me on this podcast. I was so excited to have you. You definitely did not disappoint. You have such great stories. I hope you come back and join us again.
Well, I would love to. Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
Okay, how'd it go?
He'll tell us, well, you